WJFF in Jeffersonville. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, global supply shortages. You've heard it. Supplier shortages on gifts for the holidays, labor shortages affecting businesses, new cars, and more. But it's also impacting other areas like farming and firefighting, even locally. Today we'll chat with a local farmer having trouble finding parts and a local firefighter having trouble finding volunteers. Plus, we'll check in on college life during COVID. Leif Johansson speaks to SUNY Sullivan President Jay Quaintance for his continuing COVID education series on his WJFF podcast, Close to Home, and a conversation with Eliza Evans, who's impeding natural grass extraction and experimenting with creative forms of climate change resistance through art. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Joel Snyder. President Biden is walking back comments made by his climate envoy, John Kerry, and insisting that he would not lose credibility at an upcoming climate summit if Congress has not voted on a stalled climate change bill. NPR's Scott Detrow has more.
Biden has vowed to slash U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in half by the end of the decade. Policies that would get the country most of the way there make up a big part of his Build Back Better agenda. But Democrats can't agree on an overall price tag. Kerry told the AP this week that not having a bill before the summit begins in 2 weeks would be disastrous for the U.S.'s credibility on climate change. Speaking en route back from a day of touting that bill, Biden disagreed.
It'd be good to have an agreement on the climate piece, but we're going to get the climate piece. And I think Senator Kerry is a little hyperbole there.
Biden says negotiations will continue next week. Scott Detrow, NPR News, traveling with the president.
More than 200 heads of state have been invited to the COP26 climate summit in Scotland, which is set to begin on October 31st. But Vicky Barker reports from London, it's not clear how many will actually show up.
The Guardian newspaper reports a frantic round of back-channel diplomacy is underway to try to ensure that key countries attend the two-week climate summit aimed at nailing down commitments on curbing carbon emissions. There are growing fears of no-shows by the leaders of Russia, China, and India, among the world's biggest carbon emitters and representing more than a quarter of the global population. Even Britain's Queen has weighed in. She was caught on mic earlier this week expressing bemusement at the lack of RSVPs and irritation at world leaders who, in her words, talk but don't do when it comes to the climate. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
NPR's Frank Langford also in London. He reports British police say the killing of a lawmaker on Friday was a terrorist incident and that the motive may be linked to Islamist extremism.
Police say the alleged attacker is a 25-year-old man believed to be a British national of Somali descent. Investigators have already searched two properties in the Greater London area for clues. Sir David Amos, who served in Parliament here for nearly 40 years, was stabbed to death on Friday while meeting with constituents at a local church in Essex, east of London. British officials say they're reviewing security procedures surrounding the long tradition of lawmakers holding open meetings with members of the public. Amos is the second British lawmaker killed since 2016. During the Brexit campaign, a British nationalist shot and stabbed parliamentarian Joe Cox, who supported the UK staying in the European Union. Frank Langford, NPR News. London.
British lawmakers, including Prime Minister Boris Johnson, have paid their respects to David Amos. They laid flowers this morning outside the church where he was killed. And you're listening to NPR News. At Cape Canaveral.
25 seconds.
Status check.
Go Atlas.
Go Centaur.
Go Lucy.
NASA launched a first-of-its-kind mission this morning, sending a spacecraft called Lucy on a 12-year mission to study Jupiter's Trojan asteroids. Scientists believe they are remnants from the birth of the solar system and hope Lucy will give them some clues as to how the planets were formed. A team of three Chinese astronauts docked safely today at a partially completed space station orbiting Earth. It's the second crew China has sent up to the station. And as NPR's Emily Fang reports, the mission as part of a broader Chinese effort to create a space program that can rival that of the U.S.
The three astronauts will stay for 6 months in China's new Tiangong space station. They're there to install equipment and prepare the station for future missions. The station's first module is complete, but China plans on adding two more modules soon. Once complete, the space station will be a China-led alternative to the International Space Station, which the U.S. spearheaded and launched in 1998. France, Sweden, Italy, and Russia are helping build China Station. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
The Houston Astros have taken the initial lead in the best-of-seven series for the American League pennant. The Astros took Game 1 last night against the Boston Red Sox with help from a game-tying two-run homer by Jose Altuve. Game 2 is today in Houston, and so is Game 1 of the National League series between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Atlanta Braves. The Dodgers took the pennant last year over Atlanta before winning the World Series. I'm Jael Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, thanking the people who make public radio great every day and also those who listen. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The buzzword right now is shortage. Supply shortages are cropping up in many industries, and they're also affecting the agriculture sector. Farming has turned high-tech, and digital technology plays a key role in aiding farmers in the field. The computer chip shortage impacts the ability for farms to upgrade aging equipment, which can result in revenue loss. Even farmers trying to nurse older machinery along can't get the parts to make repairs from their ag equipment supplier. The more days go by that farmers can't get in the field, the more money that is potentially lost. I spoke with Sullivan County farmer Amy Irwin, who along with her husband has been farming for over 40 years, and the shortages are causing troubles for them too.
Well, when our hay mower broke, to cut hay, a certain part went. My husband is the mechanical one, so I'm not sure exactly what part went. Trying to find a part took us almost 3 weeks to get that. And when you're doing hay in the summertime, which you only have a few months to do dry hay, it is an eternity to try if you have to wait that long to get a part. Normally, it would be hopefully just a few days. So when you have to wait that long, it can be very problematic to getting your crops in.
And you mentioned that also other folks in the area are experiencing the same things. You've heard this from others, right?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of other farmers were having that problem as well, whether it be something as simple as tires, engine parts, whatever. It was a problem. And, for a farmer who's, working on a very small margin of profit, that can be devastating if you blow a tire and you're not expecting that problem. Many of the farmers can't get parts for their newer equipment. A lot of the really new tractors have those, and I'm not sure of the terminology, but the computer chips for certain parts of their tractors. And if those go wrong, they're having trouble replacing those and finding someone to fix them, because in these rural areas, you don't have a lot of technicians that are computer savvy to fix these things. Quite often you have to take them far away or have someone travel, which is very costly to fix these computer problems in these tractors. So, it's good to improve technology, but if you're, in an outlying area, sometimes you can't keep up with that technology to get it repaired when it breaks.
How is that going to impact, do you think, the harvest for farmers and also for just the whole food supply chain?
The food supply is already going up because of the problems with the weather this year. Either they were drying up and blowing away, or they were being flooded out. So the food supplies are going to go up. That isn't going to be totally because of the supply chain shortage, but it definitely is part of why food prices will go up is that problem. But if you can't, for instance, hay this year, there is very little hay out there because the Northeast had such a wet summer that many of the farmers either abandoned fields, couldn't get them done, couldn't get their machinery in because they were too wet. the hay is going to not be good because it couldn't get dry. Out in the west, everything just burnt up, so they, you know, weren't able to harvest anything because it just dried up. So hay is in very high demand and is going to be very expensive. So if you have animals to feed, you're going to be paying more for that simple product, which drives up costs for everything else.
And the agriculture sector, especially in the area, has been through a lot, and this is just the latest hit. What do you see coming for the future, or can you even look that far given where things stand?
Well, most farmers that I know right now are going day to day, season to season. Long-term plans are difficult to foresee, with the problems of climate change and the season's changing. It's hard to even judge what kind of crops you can do, if you can manage from one year to the next. The rising costs of machinery and repair work, and even to get people to work for you is difficult. Finding someone to work on farms is always a difficult task. So most farmers that I know, if you can get through the season, you know, you're doing pretty good. So I don't know of many farmers that are making long-term plans unless, like my niece is starting a new ice cream and milk business, and she's doing very well. So that's encouraging. So I hope that we can get more young farmers into the business and come up with new innovative ideas to make agriculture a more viable future here. So if that would be encouraging to me. I've seen a couple of instances of that. So that keeps me hopeful.
And how are you guys planning for the season? Where's your mindset now when it comes to all the things that you've been through, given where you are in the middle of October?
Well, October is a busy harvest month. So since my husband and I grow most of our own food, including our meats and vegetables, right now is harvest time, so we're trying very hard to get everything either canned, frozen, or in the barn, one way or another. We're doing okay, trying to get everything in. But again, the hay season that we put a lot of our income on, it has not been good. So we're just, you know, tightening the belts and hoping that we can make it through until next year.
Are you feeling like you're getting the support from government, other industry, or how do you feel at this current phase in the pandemic and the recovery and then the shortage?
Well, I'm not exactly sure how much government can do at this point. I think that they are trying working with larger distributors to help them accomplish what they need to accomplish. But from what I understand, many of the equipment dealers in the area started working cooperatively with their inventories to, say, I've got this part, do you have that part, instead of going to the larger manufacturers where they quite often couldn't get what they needed. So they kind of started calling each other to make sure that, you know, if I didn't have this part, do you have this part, and then sending it to each other, which is helpful. If you can't find one way to get what you need, you try and find another. So I think that's kind of, you know, what we do in a rural area.
Neighbors helping neighbors.
Yes, pretty much.
I found a quote in an article about the agricultural shortage from someone who oversees the global supply chain management system for AGCO Corp. And he said it is, quote, the perfect storm of Tylenol moments. It's one headache after another.
It can be, absolutely. It can be. But quite often, when you're trying to get a harvest in or get something done in a limited amount of time, you don't have time for a headache. You just keep going. You just keep going. That's what you have to do, especially as a farmer.
Well, I appreciate you taking time out to talk to us this morning. I'll let you get back to it. I know you're busy, and wishing you luck. Thank you for talking to us, Amy.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.
be right back after a short break, taking a look at locally at shortages, including at your local fire department. This is Radio Chatskill.
Donna Fellenberg here, and on Catskill Character this week, I'm speaking with Carl Riker, conductor on the Sturbridge Railroad line out of Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Carl grew up near Piston, Pennsylvania, in a coal mining family, and his knowledge of coal mining and the railroad is astounding. His personal story is itself a revelation. Join us Saturday at 11:30 on WJFF.
Hello, I'm Aaron Hicklin. Your lovely local station, WJFF, is getting literary this season as I get to ask special guests like John Waters, Alan Cumming, and Becky Ann Baker about some of their favorite books. So join me every Sunday at noon on WJFF for Shelf Life, a new show about books and the people who love them. I think you'll enjoy it. I know I will.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Shortages are hitting every business sector, including staffing at fire departments nationwide. Volunteer fire departments sounding the alarm on dwindling participation across the state of Pennsylvania. Volunteer firefighters are in such short supply that state lawmakers are calling it a crisis. There were around 400,000 volunteers in the state back in the 70s. Now that number has fallen to just over 30,000. In New York, fire departments across the state are opening their doors to the public in search of new volunteer firefighters. Fire officials said 80 to 90% of fires across the state are fought by volunteers, and they need new recruits. I spoke with Brian Soller, first assistant chief at the Rock Hill Fire Department, about the volunteer shortage locally.
Volunteer firefighter shortage has been, you know, a topic for the last few years around the country and here in New York State, to the point where New York has put together a statewide recruitment and retention task force, and Sullivan County has done the same thing under the guidance of our fire coordinator John Hochschild. Here in Sullivan County, I would say it's very community specific. I think there are departments and communities that don't see much of a shortage, and then there are communities that absolutely see a shortage in volunteer firefighters.
Why do you think that is? What is causing this crisis in volunteer firefighters?
I think it's primarily, the world today. I mean, most people don't work. It's not your traditional family unit like it may have been many years ago, where one person in the household works. They may work locally. Today it's common for somebody to have multiple jobs. The husband and the wife to work, or whatever makes up that family unit. I don't think there's as many local jobs, so people are traveling for work, so it doesn't keep them in their community. And I think that's the biggest impact probably on some of our smaller communities around Sullivan County is, the folks that traditionally may have held a job right in their hometown, there aren't as many people doing that. So if they're not in their hometown, especially during the daytime hours, it puts a strain on that local volunteer fire company because it just doesn't have those people to pull from.
Do you think that the pandemic has had an impact as well?
I think the pandemic has probably had an impact on our recruitment over the last year and a half. I know I can really only speak from my department. Prior to the pandemic, the year prior, we probably took in at least a new member a month. So we probably took in 12 new members in that year, which is phenomenal. Once the pandemic hit, that definitely slowed down. I mean, it affected our ability to operate as a whole. We weren't in the fire station as much. We weren't drilling as much. We were only really coming in for emergencies. And for a new member, that's really difficult. For somebody brand new coming into the volunteer fire service and not be able to go down to the firehouse and hang around and be mentored and learn from the other firefighters, that's a tough way to start, in this field.
And what kind of impact does it have on, well, the community, especially as we see more and more events where we need first responders out there, whether that be on the river with, this summer with drownings or storm impacts that come through in addition to just the fires and normal calls? What kind of impact will that have, having this staffing shortage?
Well, so the great thing about the way we operate is we have a phenomenal mutual aid system. So if Fire Department X has a call at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for whether it's a structure fire or something on the river, and they don't have the staffing or enough, maybe they have limited manpower and they just don't have enough staffing to handle that issue, our mutual aid system here in Sullivan County works very well. We all depend on our mutual aid system. If I need help at an incident in Rock Hill, I know that I can count on the surrounding departments around me to supplement my manpower and my equipment when I need it. And that's really how we operate. And I would say probably what you may see is traditionally, an officer would get on the scene of an incident, assess the incident, and then if he needed help, call for help. What you might start seeing more of if staffing really does become a major issue is you might see automatic dispatches. So instead, I'll use Rock Hill and Monticello for just an example because that's where I am, right? So instead of me getting there, assessing something, and then saying, hey, I need help from my neighboring community in Monticello, that might be prearranged for certain types of calls where everybody just comes together automatically. And that's something you might see in the future more.
Should folks in the public be concerned? Are the safety still there? The service provided is still there?
Absolutely. The service provided is there. I'm not a firm believer in a sound the alarm. I don't think there's any reason to sound the alarm, that people should be afraid that the service is not going to be provided to them when they need it. I think they're definitely, the first responders here in Sullivan County do a great job. There's definitely less of us maybe. But you know what? If service is a concern to you, remember that, all but one fire department in Sullivan County is 100% volunteer. So if folks have the time and the energy and the will to, help their community the role of firefighter, and there's lots of different jobs for people in the volunteer fire service, then I would say go down to your local firehouse and offer to help.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, 90% of the firehouses are volunteer, and you mentioned that in New York, there's a statewide effort for recruitment. Given the fact that there's a lot of focus on this, do you see things rebounding soon, or what do you think might happen?
No, I absolutely do. I mean, the recruitment and retention committee that John put together here in Sullivan County has been very active, and our goal is to help departments that maybe need a little help in, advertising, different ways of recruiting new members, mentorship when you get a new member in the door, retaining them once they've joined. I mean, that's our goal, and we're out there, utilizing social media and going to street fairs and events like the Grahamsville Fair and things like that, getting out in the public, advertising the need for volunteerism and how somebody can join. You have to remember, especially over the last couple of years with the pandemic, we have a real influx of people from outside of the area, and a lot of those folks are coming from the city areas. And somebody moving out of the five boroughs of New York City that has never lived in the country, what they know is career fire service. They might not even know that the folks that come to their emergency, just left their job working for the water department or the sewer department or the business owner downtown. So that's a part of our role with this recruitment committee, and to date it's been successful, and we just hope that it keeps growing and we can help as many organizations as we can.
I recall sitting at a bar restaurant last year, pre-pandemic actually, and the bartender was serving us a drink, and then the next minute he was gone, and we asked where he went, and he was answering a call. He was a volunteer firefighter. So,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happens, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that about the volunteer fire service. Sure, people that have grown up in a community that has a volunteer a firehouse are aware of it. But, you know, there's a lot of people that aren't, and there's a lot of people out there that do have time to offer and are looking to give back to their community. And it's an extremely, extremely rewarding way to do so. And, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be an interior firefighter going into burning buildings. Like I said before, there's lots of different tasks out there that people can get involved in and help, and that's what we're looking for. And I think if we keep getting that message out there, that's what's going to help our community volunteer fire departments strive.
And if someone listening wanted to get involved or get more information, what can they do? Where should they go?
The easiest way right now would be to email us through the Recruitment and Retention Task Force, and it's joinsullivanfire@gmail.com.
joinsullivanfire@gmail.com. Okay.
Correct.
We've been talking to Brian Soller. He is the first assistant chief of the Rock Hill Volunteer Fire Department. Brian, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more than a month in, how is one local college faring with the resumption of in-person learning and vaccinations? We'll find out next. This is Radio Chatskill.
The latest Top 40 British Folk Music album chart is just out, so next time on The Waggleload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll be hearing the newcomers and the high flyers. So join me, please, for the Waggleload of Monkeys chart show next Sunday afternoon at 3.
Logging Days, celebrating Narrowsburg's logging heritage, October 16th on the riverfront. Featuring the New York State Lumberjack Association's Lumberjack Contest, a baking contest, beard and mustache contest, a kids activities area, musical performances, and more. Family-friendly fun. Logging Days, October 16th on the riverfront. More information at welcometonarrowsburg.com. Paid for by the Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Many colleges and universities started their fall terms in late August, welcoming students fully back to campus after more than a year of remote learning during the pandemic, including SUNY Sullivan in Loch Sheldrake. State University of New York Chancellor Jim Mylotras announced Wednesday that SUNY students have reached 99.5% COVID-19 vaccine mandate compliance. Leif Johansson got an update on SUNY Sullivan's progress from President Jay Quaintance for his continuing COVID education series on his WJFF podcast, Close to Home. Here's an excerpt.
At the beginning of this year, we heard from a number of folks involved in our education system about how COVID has impacted the face of education today. And at that time, we were a year into the disruptions caused by the pandemic here in the United States. So in our last episode, we followed up with Sullivan West Superintendent Stephen Walker, 8 months after our original conversation, because as luck would have it, we are still dealing with the effects of COVID to this day. But of course, our primary and high schools aren't the only educational institutions that are navigating these unusual circumstances. Our colleges and universities have to contend with it too. And here in Sullivan County, we are lucky to have a place of higher education right in our backyard. So this week, I caught up with the president of SUNY Sullivan, Jay Quaintance. There's now a mandate for all learners that go to SUNY Sullivan to be vaccinated. How has that been going, and have you gotten pushback on it?
So the history of the mandate is a little caused us some problems, and I think it did across the state. So it was the SUNY Board of Trustees made the decision months and months and months ago to mandate the vaccine, but it was all based on when the FDA would identify one of the vaccines for regular use instead of emergency use.
I see. Yeah.
That happened about a week before school started. So it didn't really give us time to get the word. I mean, we had been talking with students and saying this is likely to come, but we weren't able to get everybody vaccinated by the beginning of the semester. Right now, we have about 900 students enrolled currently for this semester. My understanding is that we're down to about 45 that have either not been vaccinated or not shown us evidence that they've been vaccinated. So we're working through those last few folks. I should say that is for students who are taking instruction on campus. If you're a fully online student, you don't need to be vaccinated, and we're not keeping track of that.
And just for an idea for folks who aren't familiar, what is the share of students that are on campus versus totally online right now?
We have about 700 on campus.
Okay.
It's a pretty large number. So of that 700, right now we're at about 43, 44 that we don't know if they're vaccinated or if they're planning on getting vaccinated. So we're working through that, but which I would say is incredibly successful. We've done a great job. Our students have done a great job. We've lost some, obviously, because they didn't want to be vaccinated for various reasons, whether they, most of them were personal issues or, you know, and in some cases, just there's a lot of misinformation about the vaccines and what the potential hazards are. And so we've been trying to educate students so that they can make a choice that's based on the best information available, as opposed to what they might find on Facebook or Instagram, which isn't probably the greatest source of information, or even just Googling, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, we can all Google things, and you Google one way, I'll Google another, and we're going to come up with two completely divergent solutions to the same question. So, we did early on mandate any students that were going to live in our residence hall needed to be vaccinated. Any students who wanted to participate in intercollegiate athletics needed to be vaccinated. So that took up, you know, that's a few hundred right there, and then a couple hundred, and then that left the rest. Our staff has done an outstanding job of getting people through this process. We knew we were going to lose some from what I hear around other colleges. We haven't lost nearly as many as some have, and it hasn't. And I don't think any of us has lost as many as we believe we might. I mean, It was just, you know, if you look at it, we're whatever, that's 98-99% of our students are vaccinated or have, have shown us that they are vaccinated against a backdrop of the county, which is somewhere around, if we count partially vaccinated, it's probably around 57 or 58%. So we're performing well in that regard. About 90%+ of our faculty and staff have been vaccinated. We just mandated the vaccine for condition of employment for management confidential and non-union employees. And, you know, with a few exceptions, everybody's complying with that. So we're pretty happy with it.
I'm glad you brought up the topic of misinformation being a prevalent issue with why some students and some folks more broadly have decided not to get vaccinated for the time being. As an institution of higher education, how does SUNY Sullivan deal with this emergence of, let's say, alternative facts, if you will?
Yeah, what a phrase that is. Alternative.
Yeah.
it's not new, obviously, but the pandemic has created, you know, this is me speaking, not me speaking for SUNY Sullivan, but the era that we've been living through for the last, I don't know, 6 years, 5 years or so, has been one where the stakes got a lot higher for people believing alternative facts or choosing to believe things that are not verifiable in the traditional sense of verification, I guess, is the way I would put it.
Yeah.
When the pandemic hit and that kind of belief system or decision-making was in place and people had sort of learned to think like that and had, I think, actually been led to think like that, it created a real public health problem. And so the stakes got a lot higher. And as an institution of higher ed, I'll put my SUNY Sullivan hat back on, I really do believe that it's incumbent on us to try to lead people in a different thought pattern. So this is what counts as a verifiable idea. This is where, science is real. You might not like the answer that comes from that, but it doesn't make it not true. It just means it's something that you choose to receive in a different way and decide for yourself how you want to think about it. But it's not the same as saying it's not true. You know, I mean, I've heard people say that one of the issues that they have with the vaccine is that it seemed rushed, or it seemed as though it was done with a high degree of profit motive, because basically the federal government is paying these pharmaceutical companies an enormous amount of money to do that. And so somehow that calls into question what the process was, or whether or not it is what it says it is, or what people say it is. But the evidence is, even if it was done from a profit motive, the evidence still says if you get the vaccine, you are much less likely to become significantly sick. If we all get vaccinated, we are all less likely to transmit the virus or let the virus mutate away from our ability to control it. So, you know, we just have those conversations with people. It's not, and for us, I don't want to argue with anyone. You know, everyone's entitled to their belief structures. But what I would like to do is just say, okay, but can we talk about it? And can we have a conversation? And, you know, we've actually gotten some students who initially were resistant to getting the vaccine, who had applied for various exemptions. And then at the end of the day, you know, somehow it comes back to an idea of a cost-benefit analysis, that they just say, oh, well, if it means that I have to do this to stay in school, then I'm going to do it, because finishing my education is more important than all of the things I may believe about the vaccine. All these other people are getting it. The problems don't seem to be there, or it's a risk I'm willing to take, and so I can complete my education.
How are you and the faculty and staff doing a year and a half into all of this? What's your sense of people's energy level and willingness to kind of just keep persevering?
Education is a social endeavor. And so how we as individuals kind of fit together and work together really has a pretty significant impact on our ability to pursue what we do. So yeah, we're fatigued for sure, but being able to open this semester and have students back on campus has had such a positive impact on morale. It's incredible, because really everyone who went into this job, you know, whether they teach biology or work in student services, or if you interact with students, it has been really horrible over the last year plus prior to being able to open. It was heartbreaking to send everyone home. You know, there were tensions that came up in any workplace, right? Like, is work being distributed equally? Are people working hard from home? Are they actually doing what they say they're doing? Then there's this other group of people who think that they're doing so much work that other people aren't, or whatever. I mean, just all of that. Most of that now has kind of gone away. I mean, because we're just back. We're back. We pass each other in the halls. We have meetings. Sure, we're still wearing masks if there's more than two of us in a meeting, but it's been really, really gratifying. I think when we get to Christmas break, it's going to feel like a major milestone that we got, if knock on wood, if we can get through it without having to close down and quarantine and do anything crazy, I think people will feel like, wow, we did this. And I know I certainly will. And I think we'll all look forward to some well-earned time off at that point, because for many people, there just hasn't been any time off. We've just been, you know, every day you just had to keep doing. And as stressful as I think it's been for me, I'm unbelievably privileged. Most of us who work here are considerably better off than many of the students that we serve. And I think about the impact that it has had on our students who, you know, all of the things that I was speaking about earlier, you know, too many people living in a household, dramatic losses of income, just stressed trying to make sure that they're educating their own kids and still taking time to educate themselves. loved ones suffering from the pandemic and possibly losing loved ones or close friends and other family members. The number of dissertations going to be written as a result of this pandemic on virtually every aspect of, you know, 21st century life is going to just make people's heads spin, because I don't think any of us have an idea on what the long-term impact is. I was just listening to a TED talk about the impact of long-term low-level stress on people's cardiovascular health, whether or not you exercise, whether or not you take proper medications, whether or not your diet is good. Just that baseline stress has a pretty significant impact on our physical bodies, and we don't really understand it. And if this has been one thing, it's been 18 months of mostly not quite so low-level stress.
Excerpt from Leif Johansson's podcast on WJFF, Close to Home. Leif and SUNY Sullivan President Quaintance also talked about some of the broader issues faced by community colleges and their students across New York State, and suggests a few policy solutions for a struggling higher education sector. You can hear their full conversation on Leif's Close to Home podcast at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Eliza Evans, an artist fighting the gas and oil industry with her art. This is Radio Chatskill. Support the fight against breast cancer this Sunday at the Coshecton Pump House, 11 a.m. to 1, with Catskill Wellness and Recovery's Uplifting Fitness Fun Day, featuring Lori Kay, Ron Todorowski, and many special guests, kicking cancer with a pumping playlist and more. Open to all. Proceeds benefit Ride to Survive Sullivan County. More information at thechihive.com. Support the fight against breast cancer Sunday at the Coshecton Pump House. Paid for by Catskill Wellness and Recovery.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, and this week we're talking about something near and dear to my heart, old school Chinese American food. Chef Lucas Sin talks about why it inspires his modern Chinese cooking, and we meet a very special Chinese restaurant family in Kansas City. That's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table at its new time, Sunday morning at 11.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Later today at 1 in Narrowsburg, artist Eliza Evans will unveil a new outdoor sculptural installation. It's entitled All the Way to Hell, continuing the artist's ongoing experimentation with creative forms of climate change resistance. It exploits unique features of U.S. private property ownership to impede natural gas extraction in Pennsylvania and in Oklahoma. The project was organized by Tal Beery and Arts and Ecology Incorporated in partnership with Tustin Heritage Community Garden, the Narrowsburg Beautification Group, Town of Tustin, and the DVAA. Eliza Evans told me about the unusual origins of this unusual form of protest.
The project evolved out of my having to solve a personal problem. And that problem was, or is, I inherited 3 acres of mineral rights in Oklahoma, you know, places I have never been, and my mother's side of the family lived in Oklahoma somewhat fleetingly, but long enough to acquire some mineral rights. And so my great aunt passed away, and they ended up in my hands. And really, I forgot about them until I started getting letters from landmen wanting access, either through leasing or buying them outright. And you know, as some of your listeners will know, the letters don't spell it out, you know, what they're willing to do and what you think you might have underneath in terms of oil and gas. You know, so I just ignored the letters, not really knowing what to do with it. And then finally I decided, okay, you know, I'm an artist. A lot of my previous work has to do with, you know, how humans interact with nature, and sometimes it addresses climate change more specifically. I thought, you know, I cannot let this happen. Let these mineral acres be fracked, if at all possible. And so I just went into major research mode, and I found not it's not a bulletproof out by any means, but it does put up some roadblocks and allow me to have, as a small landholder, an opinion about what happens to these minerals. Because it's 3 acres and you know, the oil and gas landscape is tiny. And so you can't say no. They can force me to be fracked through a process called forced pooling, which is somewhat analogous to eminent domain. Mm-hmm. So I can't say no technically, but I can make life difficult. I can, express my values, and I can, invite others to express similar values. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm doing is I'm breaking up the 3 acres into as, you know, many pieces as possible. I am giving it away to as many people as possible. And as of last month, now 1,500 people own that 3 acres in Oklahoma. And so time will tell whether this is a successful intervention. In the meantime, you know, 1,500 people have signed on. Some of them are children. Some of them are people who, like me, don't want to see fossil fuels as an important part of our future. And others are, you know, some of them are like Gen Zs or younger millennials who think this may be the only property they'll ever own. So people are volunteering for any number of reasons, which may or may not have anything to do with climate change. But in the meantime, the land agent has to go and track down every single one of those 1,500 people and attempt to negotiate a lease. Mm-hmm. So it adds time, it adds legal expense. But as they, you know, these 1,500 people are now the legitimate owners of this property, let's just see how it shakes out over the next couple of years.
This goes back to the Homestead Act, you know, owning the mineral rights underneath the land that you own, which was meant to, I guess, entice homesteaders to cultivate the West, but also stole from the indigenous population. How is this fracturing it up into smaller parcels is a headache for the private companies? How else, though, do they prevent you from just saying no? That's the part I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, they can, through the forced pooling process, and that process varies from state to state. So, they just file the paperwork, you know, with whatever state regulatory agency oversees this process. You know, I don't want to get too stuck in the arcana of oil and gas law, and I'm not a lawyer, but I feel like I've given myself a Google law degree. So a drilling unit is 640 acres, which is a square mile. So that is the acreage that a land agent has to lock up, in order to drill. In some states, it's twice the amount, but in Oklahoma, it's 640 acres. But that means that in Oklahoma, if you tie up half the acreage, you can force the remaining half. So if you have 640 acres and there could be one landowner who owns 320 acres and they work out a lease with that one, you know, mineral owner, I should say, then the other 320 can be forced through, you know, there is a regulatory process that they have to conform to. But it's, you know, this is, you know, the standard practice in a place like Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And in some states like Wyoming, they only have to lock up 25% of the acreage and they can force 75%. And so it really is kind of a 1 acre, one vote. So people with 300 acres or 1,000 acres have much more sway than smallholders.
And you turned this into an art project because, as you said, you were an artist or are an artist. Were you an environmentalist as well? Did you see both of these paths converging?
I have over the last several years. I got my MFA in 2017 and had been making art for a few years prior to that. But even before that, I call myself a lapsed academic. So I did research projects for a research center at the University of Texas. And it just so happens that a lot of the work I was engaged in concerned clean energy options. You know, Texas is, of course, known for oil and gas, but it also, I don't know if it's still true to this day, but it has, you know, the most wind energy, you know, of any state in the country, and with potential for, you know, even more vast amounts. So as an energy consumer in Austin, Texas, you know, it's a municipally owned utility where I could very easily, you know, participate in the green energy plan. So as, you know, as a researcher, as a consumer, and as an artist, you know, my attention has always been on the environment. Sometimes the focus is a little bit softer focus, sometimes a little bit harder focus. But yeah, that's been a big part of my life for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And you consider this an experiment? You quoted in an article saying it's a beta test. What do you hope to have folks learn from this, or what impact do you expect to have, not just around your own 3 acres?
Oh, yeah. If it were just about the 3 acres, it, 3 acres is inconsequential given the enormity of the challenge we face. One was I just wanted to see if I could do it, because I was told by so many lawyers, some on, you know, pro survival side of the climate change argument, saying, you know, there are no options for you. You know, you can ignore them and you're going to get fracked anyway, but you can't say no. You can say yes, or you can abstain, but those are your options. And I think one of my jobs as an artist is to imagine possibilities, even if they seem impossible or fantastical. But I'm also a pragmatist. I was like, I want this to work. And so what I found, through my very informal law degree I gave myself, was I found lots and lots of law review articles that were against what is called fractionalization, which is the fragmenting of these little properties, which happens anyway by property being passed down through the family over generations. You know, there was the original purchaser, and, you know, 4 or 5 generations later, if someone lost the trail, it could be owned by 80 or 100 people. So one thing that never occurred to me is that, you know, oil and gas companies actually have to be experts in genealogy, because they have to trace everybody's lineages, what they call back to patent, which is when it was owned by the first white settler. So they have to go all the way back and prove who owns what and how much. And that's how they know what should be on the lease. So I found this thread in the law journals. Oil companies hate fractionalization. If they hate it, but it's legal, if I took fractionalization and just shoved it off a cliff, you know, instead of 80 or 100 people, they're finding thousands. Would that be enough of a barrier for the land agent just to walk away? Mm-hmm. So just beyond my case, it's like, so this can be a demonstration project for other people. I'm surely not the only mineral rights owner who would be resistant to being fracked. However great the financial reward may or may not be. For 3 acres, it would not be life-changing, I don't think. And just saying no. I mean, this is a way to say no.
So later today in Narrowsburg, behind the Tustin Theater at 1, you're going to have reveal your new outdoor sculptural installation, which is about All the Way to Hell and about this project. What is this and how does it relate?
There are a lot of similarities in that it is a similar intervention, but with a Western Pennsylvania property, which came down through my father's family. Totally unknown to us because his family tree is a little twisted. So that they could track him down at all, it was kind of alarming to us. And he passed away 15 years ago. So, it's, It's in the hands of my mother. And this knowledge of this property came up after I already had started All the Way to Hell. So I was looking for an opportunity to have a larger conversation, because All the Way to Hell was launched over COVID. So it existed almost completely virtually. So here's an opportunity to situate All the Way to Hell in a context where fracking has been part of the conversation for over a decade now. And it's been, I think there's been quite a bit of community conflict, which is settled now. It's settled in law, at least not, if not culturally or socially at the local level. And so perhaps at the opening, you know, just starting conversations just by being in and around Narrowsburg over the next month and a half, having real conversations with real people. I think we crave this anyway in this time of distancing.
I wonder what your ancestors would think about this project. Do you think about that?
For Oklahoma, I really, my great aunt hasn't been around for quite some time now, but I think because she did have an experience of Oklahoma, and she grew up in a time when, access to energy meant progress. We just weren't aware of the consequences of that particular activity. But, it's not family land. This is not like the farm, that my great-grandfather toiled on. And, that is not what happened. The narrative is these are mineral rights, which are severed from the surface. They are inaccessible only to those who can extract from them. So that there's no emotional, it's not part of the family narrative of the things that really matter about, who struggled and who toiled and who persevered. And it was just there. And as you said earlier, part of the Homestead Act, it's not like Americans have owned mineral rights from the beginning. That was not the case at all. The federal government decided to give individuals, private citizens, access to minerals to incent them to go westward. It was a tool of settlement, of white settlement. And it worked. And except for very small parts of Canada, the U.S. is the only country in the world where citizens, private entities, own any of the resources underneath. And right now, 75% of the U.S. oil and gas resources are in private hands. I just think that's extraordinary given how communal the consequences of extracting that will be, not only in the U.S., but globally for as many generations forward as we care to think about.
We've been talking to Eliza Evans. She has a reception, an artist talk today at 1 in Narrowsburg behind the Tustin Theater, a new outdoor sculptural installation entitled All the Way to Hell, which echoes the All the Way to Hell project. You can find out more about that at allthewaytohell.com and more about Eliza at eevans.net. Eliza, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleased to do it. Thanks for listening.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. We'll be in Narrowsburg today, too, at Logging Days. Come by our tent, say hi, pick up one of our t-shirts for a $20 donation. Thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno. Have a great day.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Majestic Farm, specializing in organic apples and pasture-raised heritage meats. Open all year for contact-free meat pickup and for apple picking now through November. MajesticFarm.com.
This is WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Farm and Country is next. Showers developing later this afternoon. Thunderstorms as well, around 3 or 4. Some of them could be severe and a high near 72.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit taking legal actions providing tools for action and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond.